Hey guys, today we're talking about issues that the church is not paying attention to. And the number one issue is the military, our men and women in uniform. And man, I am so excited about my guest today, Ed Rush. He is a decorated Marine Corps FA-18 pilot. You want to talk about a top gun, he is that. At the height of his career, he was the number one instructor in the Marine Corps for one-against-one dogfighting and was instrumental in the training development of the new F-35 Lightning II Joint Strike Flyer. Ed's flown over 2,000 tactical missions. You're going to love this conversation with Ed. He is an author of a new book called God Talks. He's a nationwide speaker. That's what he does for a living, and a business consultant helping people find their good life. You're going to love this conversation. We talk about the military and everything Top Gun. Welcome to the Conversations with Christians Engaged podcast. I'm your host, Bunny Pounds, the president of Christians Engaged. This ministry exists to awaken, motivate, educate, and empower ordinary believers in Jesus Christ to do three things: to pray for our elected officials and our nation regularly, to vote in every election to impact our culture, and to engage in some form of civic education or involvement for the well-being of our nation.
So thankful, Bunny, for what you do. A lot of people talk the talk, but you really walk the walk.
I love it, love it. Love teaming up with you, Bunny. So excited about what you're doing and the people you're reaching.
And I will stand and lock arms with this woman of God, Bunny Pounds, any day of the week.
Bunny, you are a new hero of mine.
America is worth it. Now is the time. America needs your involvement. Please take our pledge to pray, vote, and engage. Join with a movement of other Christians that are doing these three simple things that can really impact this nation. Join us. Hey guys, it's great to be with you as we talk about issues that the church is not paying attention to. I'm so excited to talk to Ed Rush. Ed, it's great to have you with us today.
Bunny, what's up? So glad to be on the show. We're going to put it into Afterburner, and we're going to hit all the important topics. I'm pretty sure by the time we're done, we'll have solved all of the problems, or at least most of them.
So. All of the problems of America, brother. God, we're going to talk about God. We're going to talk America, family, all of it. Let's do it. And I love your book behind you, God Talks. I want to get into that and all of your incredible resources that you have available for people. But I just introduced you as a former Top Gun pilot, or I guess do you say former or you're currently? How do you describe
it? Either
that?
One. I just call myself a Top Gun graduate, but however you want to say it, it's fine. Okay. I always tell people when they introduce me, you're welcome to just make things up if you want to. I literally had one person take me up on that, and he stood in front of 500 people. I speak for a living, and he said, Ed was in the original Top Gun movie. You may have recognized him with the mustache. I'm like, you can't make that up. I was like 15, Yeah. But anyway, everything you said is true.
You know, a lot of what's coming out in Hollywood has just been rubbish the last few years. But I actually thoroughly enjoyed the latest Top Gun movie, and they kept it clean. It was actually a lot cleaner than the first one. But for those Americans out there, they're like, is that really what it's like? You give us the inside scoop, brother.
Yeah, that's good. It's the most common question I've gotten this year. So first of all, I went to the Top Gun movie. I bought the entire back row in this luxury theater in San Diego. I brought all my kids, four kids. I brought my grandparents. I mean, everybody. We were with a whole. I had 10 seats all across in the row. And when that movie started, you know the song, the Top Gun song. You've got the carrier that's out there, and then there's that gong, like as the song starts. I'm not exaggerating, and I'm a Marine, so I'm not a very emotional person. I literally started crying. It was so moving. Just knowing, I was in high school when the first movie came out. And it was so moving knowing how influential that first movie was for me. But I will tell you, they got that movie right. They really did in a lot of ways. Right now, Hollywood, it's sort of the same on both sides, just so you know. Hollywood has forgotten that like the purpose of a movie is to tell a great story, And the reason stories are great is because they connect with our story. There's an enemy and there's overcoming a challenge. And for some reason, Hollywood decided years ago they were going to just start jamming messages into stories, and it really ruined the story. And just so you know, we do that on our side too. We've pushed this message sometimes. Sometimes you just need to tell a really good story. And what they did in that movie was awesome. They told a great story from beginning to end. I mean, for example, they could have made a big deal about female fighter pilots. By the way, there are female fighter pilots. They're amazing. I flew with some. They could have made a huge deal about that. They could have made that like the political issue of the movie. They didn't. However, they did have an effective female pilot that was part of the story, but they didn't make the message, you know, like the story, which I thought was brilliant. The flying scenes were very realistic. By the way, the first movie, the flying scenes were not realistic at all. The flying scenes in the second movie were actually really realistic. They actually put the actors in the airplanes. There's that one scene where the actor passes out. I guarantee that happened in real life, not on purpose. They probably rewrote that back into the story. It's impossible, just so you know, to capture dogfighting because of the distance, but they did a good job as far as some of the close maneuvering. I thought the movie was great. I thought they told a good story. They even worked the F-14 into it. And by the way, if you haven't seen the movie, that's a total spoiler, but it's been like a year, okay? So like you had enough time to watch this movie.
Yes.
The way that they wrapped the end of that movie, I thought was really good. So kudos to the team for creating something I thought was really nice and certainly helped my business. I got a lot more interest in my keynote speaking right after that. So all is good.
That's what happens is sometimes things happen in the culture that help your personal life, right?
Yeah, I was not upset about that at all, actually. It was okay for me.
Well, you almost died several times. Reading your story was just fascinating, you know, where your plane just kind of went out of control and you had to regain control. Tell us a little one of those stories. And then also, how does that help you in life now as a civilian? Yeah. To consider the deep issues of life and death and how we live every day to the fullest? Or what's your perspective, brother? I'm sure that gives you a whole nother perspective.
Yeah, that's good. So for some context, so I failed kindergarten. I don't like telling that story in public, but I usually lead into that story because sometimes there's this fighter pilot thing. Like if you've ever seen fighter pilots talk, you know, they talk with their hands. You know, the joke is, how do you know if there's a fighter pilot in the room? And the answer, of course, is he'll tell you, you know. And so I always tell this, the fact that I failed kindergarten, because it sets the context for all of the dumb decisions I made in the cockpit as a pilot. And the truth is, going out of control in an F-18 is a mistake. The airplane doesn't ever do that to you. You do that to the airplane. And the recovery procedure is very unique. This airplane has a very unique recovery. But I will just tell you, I've been completely out of control twice in my career. Most pilots never experience an out of control airplane. I did it twice. The last time I did it, I was a really experienced pilot. I had just graduated from Top Gun. I was off in Japan training some young students. And, you know, when you get good at something, you start getting, cocky, you know, overconfident, brash. And I was all of those things in my youth and vigor. And I was training this really young pilot. And I was going to teach him how awesome I was. I think that was my goal that day. And so in this dogfight, we separated. Usually what happens, they can't do this in movies, by the way. It's nearly impossible. Most dogfights separate about 5 miles. Airplanes turn back in. And the distance where the airplanes are moving is anywhere from, say, a half mile to 3 miles. So there's actually quite a bit of distance. You've got airplanes moving at 300, 500 miles an hour, spinning around at 5-7 Gs. The missiles require distance. So there's this great sort of chess game that happens in the sky. But with my young student, we just accelerated, separated about 5 miles, accelerated, and then turned in. And where a dogfight starts, if you're watching this on video, you can see I'm talking with my hands.
Yes, you are.
If you're listening on the audio, it's just imagine these two hands passing each other. And usually when we start our dogfight, it's when the two airplanes pass each other. So we passed each other. His airplane was going about 500 miles an hour. My airplane was going about 500 miles an hour. So that's 1,000 miles an hour of closure. That's really fast. And we usually pass as close as we can in a safe window. That's usually about 500 feet, close enough really to look across and see the whites of his eyes. And that's where the dogfight starts. My young student pulls directly into the vertical. The F-18 can pull about 7 to 8 Gs. That's 7 to 8 times your body weight. The best way for me to describe that for you is if you were sitting on top of yourself and there were 8 of you on top of you, that force pushing down on you, that's the G force. That's what in the movie, when the guy passed out, that was from the G force, the blood pooling out of your brain, essentially. And so he pulls 7 to 8 Gs into the vertical. I pull 7 to 8 Gs into the vertical. And we pass each other essentially neutral. Neither one of us had an advantage. My young student did exactly what he needed to do on the first turn. I, of course, because I was so amazing, did exactly what I needed to do. And we passed each other at about 500 miles an hour of closure. Now, my young student at this point has several decisions. He can turn left, turn right, go up, go down. He chooses to turn left, essentially a arcing left-hand turn. He's already bled some airspeed. The turn as he begins to turn will continue to bleed airspeed because we're quite high in altitude at this point. And I go to execute a maneuver, which maybe one out of any 100 pilots could execute. It requires a lot of attention to the airplane, but I had done it over and over and over again. And essentially it's called a double Immelmann. What that means is you do half of a loop, which is the half that I already pulled, and then you do another half of a loop. And essentially what that gives you as a pilot is 4,000 to 5,000 feet of altitude advantage that can't be countered. So I'm pulling my nose up, gently kind of pulling my airplane up, and I'm looking over my shoulder at my young student who's turning. And what I'm seeing is I'm going to turn my airplane back over. I'm going to use gravity to point my nose back at him. I'm going to shoot a missile at him, an AIM-9 missile. I should say this, a simulated computerized AIM-9 missile. We don't shoot real missiles at each other in training. It would be bad for morale. And so I'm going to shoot a missile, and then I'm going to close in for the guns. That means you won. We have a video system in front of our airplane that records everything. And of course, I was going to see myself shooting my young student and winning, because that's what I always did, of course. And all of these wonderful things are going through my head in real life, my airplane is now parked completely nose high. And I run out of airspeed and ideas at exactly the same time. Now, the F-18 has an amazing flight control system, fly-by-wire, very functional, incredibly good in a slow-speed environment. But what I can tell you is if there's no air going across the wings, you're no longer flying, you're falling. What happened was my airplane begins to buck and pitch, and then it picked up the spin to the left. And I'm at about 20,000 feet over the Sea of Japan, which, for the context of this story, is one of the most shark-infested waters on planet Earth. And I'm falling to the ground now at about 20,000 feet per minute. And I'm not very good at math, but I can tell you that I have a minute, basically, to live. A minute to get myself and my airplane under control. But what's worse is the out-of-control flight procedure in the F-18 says that if you haven't recovered your airplane by 6,000 feet, it's mandatory for you to eject. So I've got about 35 seconds to get myself and my airplane under control. Now, what makes this worse is a spin is one of the hardest things to get an airplane out of. Any pilot will tell you that if you're in a spin, it's very difficult. Essentially, what the airplane is doing is it's stalled, so the airflow is not going across the wings, while at the same time, there's a massive yaw rate that typically accelerates. And the recovery for a spin is you push the stick all the way forward, and then you push the rudder all the way to the opposite of the spin. So in this case, I would put the rudder all the way to the right, put the stick forward. And when you feel the airplane coming back to normal, what you're supposed to do is pull the stick back to the middle and put the rudder to the middle. And if you don't do that within about a tenth of a second, the airplane literally will begin spinning in the opposite direction. So it's a very difficult procedure to recover from. Certainly one that's even harder when you're about to die. Certainly even harder when you're dizzy. And certainly one even harder when you failed kindergarten and you just about broke your airplane. And so what happened was about 20 years ago, some software designer decided, why don't we just code into the F-18 the perfect spin recovery procedure? That way, if the pilot screws it up, which he's inevitably going to do, the software could just kick in and take over. And so the first step in the F-18 out of control flight procedure isn't put the stick forward, rudder to the right. The first step is controls release. Literally, you let go of the entire airplane. And you're telling the airplane, you got it, essentially, at that point. The moment you release the controls, it triggers the fly-by-wire system to initiate the spin recovery. If you're going to mess with the stick, it will never go into that mode. And so the procedure goes controls release, feed off rudders, speed break in, if still out of control, throttles, idle, altitude, airspeed, and yaw rate check when recovery indicated by AOA and yaw rate tones move side forward, subsided, airspeed accelerated above 100 knots, recover passing 6,000 feet, AGL dive recovery, not initiated, eject. For some reason, that procedure is still in my brain. I didn't practice it this morning. And so given the fact that I'm hurtling to the ground at 20,000 feet per minute, given the fact that now I've got about 10 seconds to live, the question, of course, is like, what did I do? Well, as you can imagine, I'm talking to you on this amazing show that you have. And so clearly I lived, and I lived because I followed the procedure and literally let go of the airplane. I took my stick hand off the stick, my hands off the throttles. I pulled my knees up like I was some sort of flying turtle. And then at that point, I just simply prayed. I literally was like, the quickest, I mean, I'm not even exaggerating. It was like this: Lord, I thank you. I've lived a wonderful life. And if it ends now, that's fine. But really, can you just save me, please? Next thing you know, the airplane begins to recover itself. The nose pitches down. The yaw rate begins to stop. And I recover a fully, fully flying, fully functional airplane at about 9,000 feet above the ocean. A very embarrassed pilot, a very nervous pilot. I mean, I was sweat pouring down my face, but a very alive pilot and alive because of a wonderful procedure that some guy coded into the F-18. I said 20 years ago, probably more like 40 years ago, some engineer who honestly, I should buy like, a $200 Starbucks gift card or round of drinks at the bar or whatever. He deserves it for what he did. And interestingly, that procedure has sort of been with me my whole life. I have several businesses that I own and invest in. Two businesses that I own and operate, one that I'm a investor advisor to, I guess that I'm an investor advisor in. So I'm a busy person. But one of the most important things you can know as a person who wants to change the world is the first step in any extremist situation is like, just let go for just a moment. The book that you mentioned behind me, God Talks, I mean, part of my philosophy on life is your philosophy on life, which is God is in charge. He's in heaven. He's got it. He's totally got it. And we mess things up when we hold on too tight. You know, yeah. I mean, I have kids, I have four kids, and I'm sure you've like one of my kids is so intent on making life work the way he wants it to work. And I just tell him all the time, I say, hey man, like let life come to you, you know, let life come to you. And the fact is God wants to bless you. He wants to increase your life and your wealth and your business and your influence. If you have a business, God wants to bless you so that you can be a blessing. And sometimes you just need to like let your hands off and let him. And so that was like the first thing I learned out of the F-18 from my stupidity.
Yeah, that's amazing. Number one, the miracle of that software engineer that, you know, we talk about this a lot in Christians Engage, that we have the DNA of God in us. And that he's called us to have purpose and destiny, right? And so that person, whoever that person is, had the understanding that they could build something that could actually save your life, right? I mean, that's the hand of God right there. And then the ability that you had internally to surrender, right? I mean, that's the hardest thing for us to do is to relinquish control many times. And in that situation, that's a perfect example of us relinquishing control and letting God or the software, right, take over at that point. Praise the Lord, brother. What an incredible testimony.
Can I throw something in about that?
Absolutely.
So I work with business owners. You know, I left the Marine Corps back in 2006, started writing books, teaching, doing events. And so primarily I work with entrepreneurs who want to change the world. Most of the people I work with now are believing entrepreneurs. That wasn't always the case. I literally will work with anyone who has an idea or a vision that will help people. But I work with a lot of believing entrepreneurs, and I will simply tell you that across the board, most business owners, entrepreneurs, or career-minded people are working too hard and making things too hard. And I realized this, it was about 5 or 6 years ago, I was reading through the book of Genesis. If you're familiar with, you know, Genesis 1 is the creation account. Genesis 2 is another creation account, but more about the male and female that he put into the garden. And then, you know, Genesis 3, it all gets messed up. And what I realized is Genesis 3, you know, says that when you work, thorns and thistles will come from the earth. It will be difficult. It'll be hard and challenging. And I embraced that as a business philosophy because I read it in Genesis 3 and I was like, oh, you know, the curse makes work hard. But what I forgot about is first, there's a Genesis 2 work, right? Adam and Eve actually had work, labor. They loved it. It was a joy. They woke up in the morning. They were so excited. This is going to be amazing. And there's Genesis 2 and then there was Genesis 3. Well, in the New Testament, Jesus starts rewinding or working back the curses, right? So you have this like Acts 2 moment where everyone's speaking in a different language or people are hearing them in a different language. It's this rewinding or working back of the curse. He brings blessing, which is the opposite of the curse. So it's like 5 or 6 years ago, I realized, oh, wait a second. I get to choose how I run my business. I can have a Genesis 2 business or a Genesis 3. And forever, I had this like thorns and thistles, things are going to be hard, struggle. Like if you watch people on Instagram, any of the people who write personal development or business books, they always talk about it, like embracing the struggle, the grind. That's Genesis 3 type stuff, right? So what I realized, and my philosophy, I'm not even kidding you, Ask anyone I've ever worked with. They will tell you exactly these three words. My business philosophy is very simple, which is easy and light. If it doesn't feel easy and light, I just don't participate in it. And I'm, let me tell you, that philosophy has been worth like literally millions and millions of dollars of revenue for me with a lot of peace and a lot of joy. And it's your choice. And if you don't have a business, it's okay. If you're a career-minded person or if you're in the political world, you get to choose that too. You get to choose which setting you operate on. And the Lord gives you the option. You get to choose. So I choose the other one.
I'm getting delivered just talking to you, Ed, because, you know, I've been pioneering a new ministry that didn't exist 3.5 years ago. And I have to say, I've been in that Genesis 3 struggle. But I'm choosing, actually, this year, I thought, you know, something's got to change. I've got to enjoy life and rest and take a Sabbath and really enjoy the journey. So that is a good philosophy. Okay.
Can I say something? Because I know we're like on down the side road, but it's a worthy side road. So it's not that there's not work, right? So sometimes this was, I always thought that you just worked a lot and then you took off, which is true. Like you take off. But what I started to realize is there's rest and joy actually in the work. Like, when you code, I think about things like software coding. When you code the things that you're doing, like, for example, what we're doing right now, I love talking about this stuff. I could do this all day, all week, like all year. It's just thrills me, the fact that there's a person watching this right now whose life is beginning to change. It's what I do. So this is joy, right? The next thing I'm going to do is meet with some investors in a business that I'm going to have joy. Later on, I'm talking to some folks who may syndicate my podcast, joy. Later on, I'm going to do some administrative stuff like check my email. Not my favorite thing in the world, but somehow I'm going to turn that into joy too. So there's the key. Make the work rest and make the rest rest.
Oh, that's good. That's good. And remember that every person that you're hanging out with, whether it's a podcast guest, a donor, an investor, they all are people that, you know, need Jesus, should love Jesus, and that you get to invest in their life too. Okay, let's talk about the military, because I want to really focus in on a couple things. A lot of times as civilians, we don't understand the military personnel. And so we have these banquets and we have different things and we're like, please stand up if you're active military or veterans. Yay! But I grew up, my dad was in the military. He was a white coat medic during Vietnam. So I grew up in a, you know, former military family. But tell everybody here listening, why should these men and women truly be honored? In just a few words, why should we honor them? What are they doing to sacrifice their life that enables us to live ours?
Yeah, that's super awesome. In a few words, though, I don't know if I can do anything in a few words. So let me do my best shot at this. So first of all, I'm going to the Padres game tonight. One of my buddies coaches the Colorado Rockies, and the Padres are like my favorite team and they're awful. But we're going to go tonight. And there's that moment where they have all the service members stand up and everyone claps, just like you said. So I always stand up. Thank you, brother. Thank you. Thank you. But yeah, I mean, essentially what you have, I mean, it's interesting, right? The military attracts extraordinarily emotionally mature 18 and 22 year olds. And then they put them in unbelievable positions of power and authority. And somehow it works. Like the fact that we can fly around aircraft carriers at night, we're the only country that does it at night, and do it really safely is unbelievable. And it just goes to show the power of training and discipline. And the thing about the military, folks, I mean, I joined the military. I certainly didn't think I was going to die, and thank God I didn't. But the thing about the military, folks, is they do sign up knowing, hey, you know, if you're going to send me to war, I'm going to go. And that's really, I think that's the big thing. You know, it's just the idea that you're going to go. And I certainly have lost more friends, frankly, than I have fingers and toes that count, either in training or also in war. And so, I think that's it.
Well, I ran for Congress in 2018, and there was a young man when I was running that was running specifically for his comrades, right? He had suffered some PTSD in Iraq, and he had some friends that had committed suicide, and we're seeing really a huge increase in, you know, our veterans, especially young veterans that are just going down a spiral of drug use and then also suicide, right? what can we as individual Christians do to pray for them, to support them? I mean, what are some of your favorite groups that you work with? But what can we do besides just calling our member of Congress and saying, make sure the veterans are taken care of at the Veterans Hospital? I mean, there's got to be more, right?
Yeah, it's great. It's great. Thank you for bringing that up, by the way. So first of all, that's a legit issue. And the truth is, I had no idea. I mean, I had no idea. I went to Iraq twice. I frankly didn't come back with, as far as I know, any issues or anything. But one of my buddies was an infantry officer who essentially was shot at a lot. And, you know, we used to go out and like our families would hang out and stuff. And we were going to go, I was going to go out on this boat on the 4th of July. And he's like, no, I skipped the 4th of July. And I'm like, what's the deal with that? And he goes, it just terrifies me, you know? And he started explaining what happens when fireworks go off and what happens to his body and his mind. And it was so foreign to me because, again, I did not experience, as far as I can tell, any of those issues. So it's legit. Like, this guy was a strong, you know, capable, godly person. Like, there was no, it wasn't like I was like, you know, lean on Jesus or whatever. Like, he was leaning on Jesus.
Yeah.
And so, like, first of all, it's totally an issue. Second, just to give credit where credit is due, we generally across America have a very low view of Congress. I think it's like 7% approval or something. It's really low. And let's face it, our Congress is like totally screwed up. But there's one area that gets near 100% bipartisan support almost across the board, almost every time, and that's the VA. There are committees in the House of Representatives. There is a committee specifically related to veterans relations. I sat in Congress one day, literally, I think I was the only person there besides the two representatives of those committees. And I watched the votes go down regarding the VA, and it's literally like 98%, you know, the only reason the other person didn't vote is because they, you know, some dysfunction or whatever, they're from Chicago, something like that. But the bottom line is, to give credit to Congress, there has been a lot of attention, a lot of awareness, a lot of support, and frankly, a lot of money put not only into the VA system, but also into PTSD. And the first step in that stuff is always awareness. And finally, we got to the point as a culture, like in World War I, we had people come back who were shell-shocked. We had no idea what to do with those people. They walked around in circles and stuff. And so finally, we have places where people can get help. And the VA legitimately does. The VA screwed up in a lot of ways, but their PTSD approach is actually pretty solid as far as I can tell.
That's awesome. Yeah, I mean, I think we're living in a different generation where people understand that we can talk about anxiety and, you know, issues that we've had in the past, right? And we can heal together, which is a good place to be.
And not to mention the fact, I don't think I ever say anything nice about Congress. That was very refreshing. It feels really good.
Doesn't
to say
it feel
something
good? I know.
Nice about. I mean, normally, I'm like, all those awful people, you know. But anyway, there really are some good people there. I shouldn't be so mean there. I mean, I know some of those guys. Like, there are people who are there who really, really care. It's an unbelievably hard job, as you know.
Yes.
I mean, you know better than I do. Unbelievably hard to be able to move the ball forward in any significant way. So I do really appreciate the folks that work there. I'll be there in a week.
Yeah, I told everybody if I got elected to Congress in 2018, which I almost won, but I would join the Veterans Committee, and everybody was like, why? Your boss was on a committee in financial services. Why would you go down to that horrible C committee, right? Well, yeah. I fell in love with the veterans in my community on that race, and I had nothing more that I enjoyed more than hanging out with those veterans, and especially East Texas. They were my buds. So let's talk about, as we close out here, there's so many issues, but we are seeing some issues within the military. And I know it's been happening for decades, but I think for me as a civilian and one that really appreciates religious liberty, it was very difficult to watch the U.S. government force our military into taking COVID vaccines against their religious feelings. And some of, you know, they couldn't get religious exemptions. And we're still seeing lawsuits happening related to that. But also just some of the policies that are coming down from the hierarchy and some of the folks that are being nominated for the chief of, you know, the chief military people. I mean, it's kind of crazy, like the elitist mentality, I guess. So I guess can you comment to that as somebody that's served in the military?
Yeah.
How do we keep people recruitment up, and how do we navigate all that?
Yeah. So first of all, it's a major problem. And I will just say the conversation we're about to have isn't about the vaccine. It's about forcing military members to do something against their conscience. I was required to take the vaccine for anthrax. And just so you know, how they administer that is they pull out of the freezer live anthrax and shoot it into your arm. And I was not comfortable with that at all. I was told if I didn't take it, I would be leaving the military. At that point, I was on my way into Top Gun. I was moving forward in my career, and I felt like I had no other choice. And I look back and I'm like, they dropped that program. They literally a year later dropped the program and didn't tell anyone why. It just went away. And I was like, wait a second. Like, what, you know, it's still in my mind. I'm like, I wonder, like, you know, anthrax in your body.
And for full disclosure, Ed, my dad was a white coat medic, meaning he was a Seventh-day Adventist non-combatant, and he didn't have to go to Vietnam. But what they did is germ warfare on him. They threw up rabbit fever in the air and said, hey, let's go watch him while he goes to 104 temperature or whatever, and see how it takes to metabolize in a system. And I mean, that's the kind of stuff they were doing on our military back then. But there's just this kind of stuff it's interesting to watch in the modern world.
So one of my most favorite missions when I was in Iraq back in 2005, I was flying essentially circles, you know, over the center of the country. And I had a friend of mine. His call sign was Gretzky. He was a Ford air controller. He was on the ground because he had done something really stupid in Australia the year before. And that was essentially his punishment. But my buddy's down there with a radio and an infantry platoon. And across the city, this band of young military-aged Iraqi teenagers and 20-year-olds essentially start banding together with rocks and sticks and weapons. And they're forming in the city. And my buddy's platoon is over here, and they're forming in the city. And it's like not looking good. High noon sort of showdown. And these things never end well. Like, they never end well. You've got civilians that are sort of mixed into that thing. And so what he did is he just called me, and my call sign was Head. He said, Head, could you do a show of force? And essentially he gave me the coordinates. Now, here's what a show of force is. I have a fully loaded F-18. I've got two drop tanks full of fuel. I've got rockets across the entire airplane, some Mark 82s, which are 500-pound bombs, AIM-9 sidewinders. I am loaded for bear. But a show of force is you drop down to about maybe 100 feet, which is really low. And you turn on the gas. I'm talking about full afterburner. An airplane like that that's fully loaded typically won't go Mach 1, which is the speed of sound, but it'll get really close. So Mach 0.9, Mach 0.95 is very close to the speed of sound. What that means is there's very little sound moving ahead of the airplane. All the sound's moving behind the airplane. And when you move into that regime, which is called transonic, when you're close to Mach 1, which is the speed of sound, it basically sounds like you're ripping the air open. It's a sound that you probably have never experienced. It's the most terrifying thing that you'll ever hear, and no one hears it coming. And so all of a sudden, there's all these Iraqi militia, essentially, that are forming up against our folks. And then out of nowhere, this airplane rips the sky into and explodes the sky and then pulls directly in. What I did was fly right over the city full beans and then literally pull directly up like I'm a rocket ship and shoot up to about 10 to 12,000 feet. That's all I did. I didn't shoot any weapons, didn't shoot my gun, didn't shoot anyone. I literally flew by fast. And that was enough. People were running for cover. I'm talking about like diving and ducking and running. And next thing you know, my buddy's platoon is having lunch. I mean, that's as quick as you can do it. And part of the purpose of the military, you'll notice no one shot anyone. No one got killed. There were no bullets that flew. I didn't shoot anything. Sometimes the purpose of the military is to simply look like a badass so people don't touch you. Like, the purpose sometimes of the military is not even defense. Sometimes it's just to be there and to have the enemy go, man, we do not want to mess with them, right? And just so you know, you can make application, what I just said there, you can make application to any area of the country right now. For example, the border could use what I just explained there.
Yes.
If people looked at the border and said, do whatever you do, look, don't mess with them, right? If somebody was carrying drugs, like I told you in the preamble to this, I lost two siblings to fentanyl. If someone carrying drugs across the border was afraid that in any moment they would get a bullet through their forehead, they probably would be less inclined to do it, right? You could talk about the cities and crime. You could talk about the military. And fundamentally, the reason that we treat sometimes our military, I shouldn't say we, I should say they, the reason they treat our military like an experimental ground is because we don't have any enemies around us. Like, we live complete oceans. Like Israel is surrounded completely by enemies.
Right.
Israel knows what a military is. They're like, at any moment they can get shot at, right? Countries like Iran or Russia, for that matter, or the Ukraine, they're countries that are completely surrounded by enemies. We're surrounded by water, and Canada's useless, and Mexico's nearly useless. And we're just sitting out here all by ourselves. And because of that, we feel very safe. And when people get safe, they get all snooty, and they decide to use the military as a proving ground for some sort of social project. And just so you know, if you're listening to this, we're not even talking about medication or the vaccine or any of those philosophies. We're simply talking about what the military is for. And the military is there to defend the country, not to be a proving ground for your social experiment or whatever. So,
amen, brother. And so we need to get us back to the Constitution. You know, the reality of the Constitution is that the government in its rawest form is to protect the people of the United States, right? We talk about a lot of times on this show or everything we do with Christians Engaged, the idea of limited government, that when government overextends its purpose, right, then you have to think, is that really what government's supposed to be doing? Well, there's nothing more important for government to do than to protect the people of the United States.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's what the military is all about. And that's why we should bipartisanly support the military and support those families that have really given up their life for our nation. Right. And I've met IDF soldiers over in Israel. They're amazing. I mean, if you can imagine, everybody in Israel has to have service. So when they're 18, they have to do their 2 or 3 years of service. It just makes the whole citizenry is completely different because they all come out of military service. It's a different philosophy and feeling, right?
That's right on.
So as we close out here, talk about your book. And man, God is moving in people's hearts and lives. Yeah. And I love that you have so many different stories and different things that God's brought you through. But your overall vision, Ed, is to inspire people to walk with God, to talk with God, to know him. Why is that so important to you? And tell people how to find you.
Yeah, great. Thank you for that. Everyone, by the way. So it was about 10 years ago, I actually started having these conversations with God in prayer regarding my business. I never thought he was interested in business. I always thought he was interested in like church and worship and giving and stuff. And then all of a sudden I realized like, oh, God really wants to change the world. Wow. And technologies and like new ideas. And it like opened my eyes, you know, like, for example, I say this all the time and I get criticized for this comment, by the way, but over the last, say, 18 months, Elon Musk, frankly, acted more like a kingdom-minded person than most kingdom-minded people acted, because what he understood was ownership and acquisition is like half the battle, you know? And I just wish more believers, you know, had a vision for changing the world through entrepreneurship or through business. And so I started having these conversations with God, and it was about 7 years ago that I started teaching entrepreneurs how to do that. And it was about 2 years ago that I started making it literally my full-time mission to show people how to ask God questions specifically about their business or their calling and get answers. And I've done this process with literally over 10,000 people. Unbelievable success. I'm not exaggerating when I tell you, I do these live events. I've literally had atheists with like notepad, like a yellow notepad, like the one that I have in my hand, walk up to me at one of my events with their yellow notepad and say, "Ed, I'm an atheist and I have 2 pages of notes from God. How does that work?" And I'm like, you're the atheist. You tell me how that works. And I, by the way, sometimes people get upset when I tell them that. They say, "How could you teach an atheist how to talk to God?" And I just tell them, "Well, see, God loves them, and because God loves them, I love them. You know,
and He's talking to them whether they're admitting that He's talking to them or not. He's after them.
I mean, unbelievable. The stories. Oh my goodness, the stories that I've heard of people overcoming lifetimes of abuse because of a conversation with God. Anyway, so I do these big events called God Talks Live, and I have this book called God Talks. And there's a series of audios that come along with the books, which I'll tell you where you can get those as well. And essentially what they are guided conversations with God. And if you're one of those people like that, you know, you don't think that God speaks or whatever, well, that's who I was 15 years ago. Literally, I didn't believe in any of this stuff. I thought it would have been heretical. And then all of a sudden I started having these conversations with God. And I can tell you, that his voice is love and that his voice is kind, and he can be very direct in helping you achieve what he wants you to achieve. And there's no better time than the present. Our world is in a very dark place, not only politically, economically, in terms of leadership, in terms of education, business, the arts, you go across the board. And the reason for that, just so you know, one day I was sitting in my chair here and I was praying and I said, I was complaining about the government. It was back in 2015. I was complaining. And God said to me, well, that's not your fault. And I was like, yeah, that's true. It's not my fault. And he goes, but now it's your responsibility. And I was like, oh man, he got me. And the thing about it is, as believers right now, we're very critical of the government and we probably should be. We're very critical of education and we probably should be. We're very critical of media and Netflix and the arts and stuff. And we should be, but we haven't even stepped up to what we're called to do. And so maybe we should be critical of ourselves first, like judgment begins at the house of God, right? Maybe we should say, hey, you know what? I'm going to take responsibility for not stepping up, for not, like, for example, when you ran for Congress, that was you saying, hey, like, here am I, send me. I'm going to step forward and I'm going to make a difference. And you've done that, like with all the campaigns that you've run and all the people that you've put into place, you've made a huge difference. That's there's faith and works. And you put those things together and do that. And this book is about making that happen. And the website, I know you're going to ask, so I'll just say the website is godtalks.com, easiest website you can remember on planet Earth. It not only has a link to the book, which you should get, by the way, it's the best book you'll ever read. I'm biased, but that doesn't mean I'm not right. Okay. And also you'll get, I just created this whole series of audios and videos that you can just download it and you can get all the training you want totally for free. You don't have to pay me a dime. That's all there on that website. It's my mission. Literally, my plan is to move this into stadiums, to go into the mall in DC and fill the mall with people who are asking God questions about their life and getting answers, because we do need to change the world. And there's no better time than the present.
I love it, Ed, but I'll disagree. My book coming out February 6th, Jesus in Politics, is the best book that is coming out.
No, I love it. And you're biased, but that doesn't mean you're not right. See?
Hey, you know what? When you go through the toil and the sweat and the tears and the six different editing processes to get that book in print, it's a huge win. So congratulations and thank you for serving. And everybody go to, I think your personal website is edrush.com, right? For speaking engagements. So check out Ed if you need to book a speaker for a banquet or an event. He would be a great speaker to bring to your venue. And thank you so much for giving us a new inside look to the military. And we really appreciate you, Ed. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Thank you so much for joining us for this incredible podcast. What in the time we've had. We love you so much. We love being in your life. Have you subscribed? Have you shared this with your family and friends? Please subscribe on Apple, Spotify, YouTube, Rumble, wherever you get your audio or video pods. We need your help. This mission is undergirded by individuals just like you that support this ministry monthly, annually, and whenever you think about us, to be able to reach over 1 million Christians in the next 2 years. That's our goal. We want to empower 1 million Christians around America to pray, vote, and engage regularly. Will you help us? We're here to do that, and we need your help. I want to say thank you to our partners at The Stream. What an incredible online publication put out by James Robison and Life Outreach International. As we come together across denominational lines as believers to discern what God's saying about the news of the day and to hear from different viewpoints, check out The Stream, make it your homepage, and get on their email list. This product is amazing. Also, our partners at Edify App, put out by Christian Post. This podcast app is a convergence of Bible teachers around America. We're excited to be a part of Edify App. Check out all their other podcasts. Thank you so much again for caring about this nation. We're here to help you pray, vote, and engage. We'll see you next week.